Okay, put on your Stone Age head. You're back on the savannah 10,000 years ago. Things look radically different to what they do today. And of course they are. But my guest today thinks what isn't that different are your instincts. And what's more, we shouldn't be following them. They're making us come unstuck in ugly and deadly ways.
There's a group of researchers in the United States that have started trying to promote the term sedentary death syndrome because they think that is so much scarier than it just means you're going to get all these illnesses and potentially die sooner if you don't exercise and you eat too much. But sedentary death syndrome that everybody's at risk of
that is
kind
fantastic.
Of gets your attention.
Sure does. All in the Mind with Natasha Mitchell, coming to you today from the Royal Institution of Australia, the RIOS Science Exchange. In the heart of Adelaide, our guest is Dr. Deirdre Barrett, a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School's Behavioural Medicine Program and past president of the International Association of the Study of Dreams, a research and clinical focus of hers. She also writes books, and her latest is called Supernormal Stimuli: How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purposes. And so, yes, it's all about your urges today. Last week, we heard about the psychology of that urge to eat to the point of obesity. And for Deirdre, it all starts with the notion in evolutionary psychology that we house Stone Age minds in a 21st century skull.
Do you think that's how it really is, though? I mean, are we really stuck back on the savannah when we think about our mind and our behaviours and our dispositions, our instincts?
Yes, I think our instincts are there. I mean, one thing that is different about humans that we did evolve long ago is much more flexibility in our behavior because we're such a long-lived species with such a large brain. Much less is rooted in really simple instincts. And so we have much more cortex than most animals in this whole prefrontal area that does all this abstract thinking. So we can override instincts more easily than most animals. But yes, I do think our basic instincts are there for that hunting-gathering lifestyle. And the phrase that at least in the U.S. is popular about just trust your instincts or listen to your body, that would really lead you toward the right thing if you were in a small tribe on the savannah. And it may lead you toward food that's really bad for you and spending all your time in front of a television instead of with real people and all kinds of things in today's modern technological society.
So that's what we want to unpick today. Why you think there's this really powerful disconnect between our Stone Age minds and our contemporary environment. So you draw on this idea of supernormal stimuli. Tell us about the chap who originally coined that phrase and the extraordinary work that he did. He was a Nobel laureate for it.
Nico Tinbergen came up with the phrase, and he was studying animals, mainly birds and fish, actually, insects sometimes, their behavior. And he was interested in what their instincts were actually coded for, and he approached this by creating dummy objects to vary one thing at a time. And this picture up here is made fake bird's eggs, varied the size and the color and the markings. And basically he found that bigger was better, that whatever the natural color of the egg was, a more intense color was better. If it had any little gray dapples, big black polka dots were better. So he could get a bird that laid a pale blue gray dappled egg to sit on this giant bright blue black polka dotted egg that it would slide off and ignore its real eggs because it wasn't coded for the gestalt of a healthy egg. It was coded for blue polka dots, big.
come and get me.
Yeah.
I mean, it was almost comical, some of the things that he observed. Tell us about the volleyball and the goose.
Yeah, it's sitting for most types of birds, but for ground nesting birds, if their eggs get dislodged from the nest, they have a natural instinct to roll them back with their beak. And just like with which eggs to sit on, the healthiest egg gets rolled back first if multiple ones are out. Mm. And for certain kinds of geese that lay medium brown eggs, they will choose a volleyball over the egg to roll back first.
Where's the survival instinct in that? trying to give birth to a
It's because animals
volleyball.
Don't very often encounter supernormal stimuli that look like the thing their instinct is coded for, but are more intense. If there had been sort of big fake eggs sitting out there, the instinct probably would have evolved somehow to rule them out. But animals only encounter the supernormal stimuli when some evil experimenter starts making them. But we're making them for ourselves. From the start of technology, we've reversed the relationship between instinct and object. And instead of relying on our instincts to lead us toward the objects they're supposed to, we've begun to manufacture objects to optimally appeal to the instinct. And that ends up being the supernormal object, the equivalent of the giant polka-dotted egg that's not at all necessarily good for us.
So this supernormal, so normal but super stimuli, seems to explain quite a lot of behavior in the wider animal world, doesn't it?
Yes, he did experiments with mating instincts. He could get a male butterfly to try to mate with a cardboard butterfly if the stripes were more dramatic down the side. It didn't even need wings. It needed something shaped like the female butterfly torso with the stripes on it. And again, ignoring the real receptive female there, it would go for the better
the striped cardboard torso.
Cardboard one.
How depressing.
And the eggs led to all kinds of things. After eggs hatched, the parents would prefer to feed a fake beak on a stick if it was wider and or brighter red inside than the real chicks. It didn't matter if there was a chick attached. And the chick would try to beg food from a fake adult beak if it had exaggerated size and markings. So for just about every instinct, he could get the animal to try to nurture, try to be nurtured by, try to mate with, try to fight with some really silly-looking object to our eye that had a more intense version of whatever was the releaser for that instinct.
Which brings us to humans. Because you think we are also seduced by supernormal stimuli, and that's a big worry for you.
Yes. I mean, the reason I wrote this book is evolutionary psychology has picked up a lot of Darwin's ideas and some ethology ideas, which is the kind of Darwinian branch of animal behavior that Tinbergen was a part of. But somehow, evolutionary psychology never adopted the idea of supernormal stimuli, and I really think that of all of the evolutionary concepts, it's the most important and the most directly relevant to human behavior.
And for you, it starts with food.
Yeah. So I actually, 3 years before Supernormal Stimulus, I wrote another book, which actually my working titles don't feed the animals, but it got titled Wasteland, spelled Wasteland by the publisher. And it was basically just applying the concept of supernormal stimuli to what's wrong with our health, to eating, to exercise, to some of the things that have gone wrong about our physical health. And although I think everyone is aware of what's wrong with our modern refined food, what's not healthy about it, we may not take it seriously enough, but we're aware of it. When you look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, it started way before that. It really started with agriculture. Humans on the savannah were eating this vast array of food, the majority of their diet being leafy green vegetables and little bits of meat, little bits of seeds, little bits of fruit when it was in season, but just lots and lots of vegetables. And as soon as people began agriculture, grains became the vast staple of the diet, whereas seeds and their equivalent had been a small part.
So rice and wheat. Yeah. And
And they started growing the grains to have more and more calories, and somewhat by accident, less and less of any of the other nutrients. So the teosinte, which is the ancestor...
So here we've got, just for the radio audience, we've got two... just to describe the picture we're seeing.
Yes, sure. The ancestral teosinte, which is the plant that corn came from, has these narrow seed pods that are... lots of fiber, lots of vitamins and antioxidants, and relatively little simple starch. And then you have
corn.
But
it looks revolting.
It looks, dry and chewy, and not many people would be choosing that they want to eat the teosinte, but it's much better for you. The corn has lost most of the fiber, most of the antioxidants and vitamins, and has gained just all the starchy. It's got more calories than that.
And it tastes so sweet.
Tiny. Yes, more sugar, more starch, but less nutrients. And agriculture sort of refined foods into lots of sugar and starch even before modern technology started refining it further and further.
Back on, if we're thinking about our behaviour and our eating behaviour, back on the savannah, we were drawn to the same things, weren't we? We were drawn to fat, sugar, all the things that gave us energy.
Fat was scarce. It was nuts or certain meats, although animals were much leaner then. So getting a little fat was important, and that's why it was hard to find. We're really coded for that. Sugar was basically mainly in berries, which were, and other fruits, which were only around in smaller supplies at certain times of year. Salt was relatively hard to come by. We weren't mining it out of the earth, and yet we need to have some in our body. So these are the things that were really coded to look for because they were hard to find. And it's not that humans didn't eat lots of green leafy vegetables and have a mild draw toward that, but they were not hard to find, so they were not the prioritized good taste.
But if we've got these big brains, why are we so hell-bent on eating what kills us?
Well,
are we really that stupid? Or is it our instincts that are stupid in the modern context?
Well, our instincts are what are leading us toward eat the cheeseburgers, drink the milkshakes, just follow the simple instincts. But I think another issue is that we're much more coded for threats that will kill us right now. If a lion walked in the room, that's something that your savanna instincts know what to do about. And the idea that there's a correlation with getting cancer and type 2 diabetes 20 years from now is not really as coded in.
But
as
it, in terms of our health, it is the equivalent of a lion walking into the room, isn't it?
Yes. There's a group of researchers in the United States that have started trying to promote the term sedentary death syndrome because they think that is so much scarier than it just means you're going to get all these illnesses and potentially die sooner if you don't exercise and you eat too much. But sedentary death syndrome that everybody's at risk of
gets
your attention. So I think we don't perceive the risk, and we don't think about it realistically.
Are people paying attention?
Yeah,
I think obesity is on the rise if we look at the latest data in Australia.
I'm optimistic long-term. In the States, we've really turned around on tobacco and smoking, and it took a long time after the statistics were there on how much lung cancer and other causes of death were related to smoking. And it kind of started with not advertising cigarettes to kids. And I think that you just see the preliminary hints of that with people getting more aggressive about not advertising junk food to children. So I think one can make that shift, and people do it when they really appreciate the danger, like take most really dramatic illegal drugs. People know that snorting cocaine or shooting up heroin would feel really good right now, but we're not all doing it or seriously considering doing it because we really recognize that that's not natural and that's not good for us and that might result in our deaths down the road. And you don't hear people saying, oh, I know my kid shouldn't take heroin, but he likes it so much. How can I, deny him? So if we just really get it through our head that certain eating habits really will kill you, and they'll really shorten your child's lifespan if you encourage them to eat a certain way, I think that we have the cortical equipment to put the brakes on just simple instinct stuff once we really perceive the risk and take it seriously. And we're not there for food yet, but
we're sure not. It's amazing, isn't it?
But we weren't there for tobacco 30, 40 years ago.
Dr. Deirdre Barrett is my guest on All in the Mind on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia, author of Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose. After food, the next best primal urge is surely sex, starting with your first crush. Deirdre draws on a large study from the 1930s and others since, which have looked at what sparked people's first crush. Was it personality, physical characteristics, or moral character? The results of most surveys like this produce the stereotype that more women than men are drawn to personality and intelligence, more men than women drawn to physical attractiveness, and not much chop for either on moral character, as it turns out. So we're putting that question now to an anonymous electronic vote here at the Royal Institution Science Exchange in Adelaide.
And here's the vote. You liars!
Much closer to even than in most crowds. That's very interesting.
So let's spell it out. We've got personality. We've got 55% of men voted on personality versus 51% of women.
Would certainly be statistically insignificant differences in each column, but the main thing that's interesting is that there's not a gender
difference. Well, more women
than
men.
Usual.
47% of women voted on the hot and sexy versus 45%
yes.
of men. You're just trying to get us all in the sack, aren't you? And 2% of women.
Yes, that is the one way in which this is a completely typical group.
There's a 0% of men, so we clearly have a totally amoral audience of men here at the Royal Institution.
Of course not. And in my books anyway, stereotypes are made to be broken. Only perhaps our instincts don't know that.
So what's this got to do with supernormal stimuli?
That crushes are sort of a supernormal stimuli. Very few people in either group, but especially the modern group, just described crushes on their peers. But most of them were on celebrities. For the modern group, that was pretty much singers, actors, and sports stars.
Which is a desire
yeah.
that will never be fulfilled. So in a sense, this is a stimuli that's
yeah.
gone astray.
In the older group, it was sometimes just prominent people in the community who they didn't really know, but they at least physically saw in the 1930s. But it was still screen actors and things too. And so crushes, at least in our modern sense, are... they're pulling on something that was there for beginning to establish real relationships with a member of the opposite sex, but they're really being pulled off toward these things that don't achieve that.
Which is why you find it rather extraordinary that some people want to have sex with a paper centerfold rather than a real human being.
It's really just like that paper butterfly, which looks so bizarre to us, that doesn't have to have wings, it just has to have stripes down the side, and will ignore the real live female. But that's not very different than what goes on sometimes with pornography. I mean, a flat 9-inch image of a woman as sometimes more attractive than a real woman is really just as bizarre as what the butterflies do.
Well, if we were to make a dreadful assumption and draw a dreadful stereotype and say that, well, it's fairly obvious what men might find to be supernormal stimuli about women, that's probably as clear as the nose on my face, times two. What about women? What are your conclusions about women and supernormal stimuli in terms of attraction stakes?
Yeah, one thing that's different in judging one's own gender, people like all of the things that seem to be signs of health, like facial symmetry and smoothness of skin, these things are valued for both genders. But then for the opposite gender, anything that's very specifically a sexual characteristic of that gender that correlates with estrogen and testosterone levels, that's where women rate, you know, sort of men having broad shoulders and muscles and defined jaw, and men start liking that small jaw, big eye, things that are kind of fertility indicators rather than just health.
So that's the evolutionary story. We like people better
if they look healthy and friendly.
And we'll have our children and carry them to...
Well, specifically for the opposite gender, we want them to look high in testosterone or estrogen.
Do you buy that? Do you buy all that, those sorts of evolutionary stories about beauty and attraction? Is it all just about getting a bonk and having a baby?
I think a lot of it is about detecting friendliness in others and health in others and some other things. But then, yeah, I think the choosing a mate, who you want to date, who you want to whatever, is very much about detecting fertility, detecting cues about, you know, who may be good in raising a child. Yeah.
Very interesting indeed. I mean, from nurture, you also thread war into this theory, and you have a hypothesis here too. There's a lovely quote. Oh, it's not really a lovely quote. It's actually quite a devastating quote, but it's a very powerful quote that you pull from Plato, which says, "Only the dead have seen the end of war," which is very confronting, isn't it? It says that war is always with us. Do you think war is essentially a core part of human nature?
Yes, at least violence and aggression, and especially defensive, threatened violence, I think is very hardwired into us. And short of genetically engineering humans differently, I don't think we'd ever see the end of war. But I definitely think that just like with these eating and mating and everything else behaviors, that the stimuli out there have a lot to do with how much of it there is.
I mean, what you do point out, which is very striking, is that humans are the only species that kills our own species en masse.
Yeah, I mean, you see wolves fight, and they fight and they really hurt each other for a while, but as soon as it's clear that one is winning the fight, the loser actually bares its throat and the stronger one stops the aggression, and they have established that the one that lost will be subordinate in behavior to the one that won, but he doesn't have to be killed to stop trying to better the alpha wolf. And I think that what's happened with human aggression and defense is that we magnify threat symbols that media kind of flag. I mean, the United States before invading Iraq was just hearing this, you know, they're building up weapons of mass destruction, they're going to be lobbying chemical biological warfare at you, you know, any second. Like, just any sign of real threat gets broadcast a lot. Fake threats get broadcast a lot. And then surrender signals don't really get seen. I mean, when we're dropping bombs on another country, we don't as immediately see the graphic images of the effects, much less are we showing the people who are trying to give up. We're showing the people who are still fighting us. So I think that part of that is just inherent in technology and media, and then part of it is very intentionally manipulated by leaders, politicians, the military to sway opinion.
And there's an evolutionary story here too, in that it was appropriate for us to look after our own kin so that we could kind of convey our genes into the next generation without the sort of threat of them being diluted by others. So that's where some people have said that sort of territoriality comes from, and that kind of defence of our own. But we've taken it to another extreme, you suggest.
Yeah, there's another ethology concept I talk about in the book, of the idea of a pseudo species, which only humans seem to... All animals have one set of behaviors for any other species, you know, rules about when they'll kill other animals. And not that they never kill their own, but there's a very different set of rules that apply to fighting with your own species versus another. And humans sometimes seem to get into modes of thinking of their own as just the people of a certain nationality, or just the people of a certain religion, or just the people of a certain language. And in the lead up to almost any war, you see people starting to come up with slang terms for the other side that kind of implies not quite human, or sometimes it doesn't just imply. I mean, in the genocide of the Tutsis, they were being called cockroaches by
and broadcasting
the other side.
It over the radio.
That was the slang for Tutsis, was the word for cockroach. So sometimes it's as explicit.
So you evoke the feeling of disgust against the other.
Yeah, or the idea of not human, something else. I think that the internet is very helpful for this sort of threat war issue, because I think the conventional media has always been somewhat specific to a country and tended, at least at times of big conflict, to follow the dictates of its government. And the internet doesn't do that. It's completely international and it's not following anybody's orders. So I think that we may begin to see surrender signals and begin to get more overt messages about how much people on the other side are just like us than this kind of propaganda about differences. I think the internet may definitely make some difference.
So the internet's okay, but you think television is a big boo-boo in this conversation about supernormal stimuli. You think telly has just roped us in with terrible consequences.
Well, I think it's a supernormal stimulus for social impulses, for a few others also, but mainly for social impulses, that we're coded to like sitting around talking and listening with smiling, happy, friendly people, and this establishes social bonds. And television can just, with its laugh tracks and its actors who can just look happier and friendlier and more vivacious than any real group of people you're going to
really
be in the room
with.
But
they really are my friends, those people on the telly.
But they don't know you're alive, and they don't care about you,
and
you're not establishing real social networks that will support you. And in fact, you're taking time away from doing that. And then sort of back to the sedentary death syndrome, you're not getting any exercise while you do that. Not that all socialization involves a lot of exercise, but we get really abnormally still when we sit and stare at a television in a way that we don't when we talk to real people. So yeah, people emphasize the content in television is bad, but I think really just that there's a lot to the medium that is very bad for us. Whereas I think the internet is much more of a mixed bag. It's almost as bad for us in how sedentary it is in terms of lack of exercise, but socially I think it both promotes certain real things and also has some TV-like effects. Supernormal.
Clearly, not all supernormal stimuli are bad for us. You know, we are stimulated by, extreme beauty and art and music and things that might not feel like they're terribly pragmatic ways to use our time, but they inspire us so. So we kind of need our supernormal stimuli as well, don't we? We want to soar the great heights.
Certainly things like visual arts and literature are somewhat supernormal stimuli, but I think the greatest literature may actually condense some of the benefits of real social interaction, that you might actually, in reading a great novel, learn more per hour about human relationships than you would relating to a real human being, which is not the case for the television that pulls the social instincts equally strongly. But many of them, I think, they do no more than potentially waste time, but then others are potentially quite deadly.
So, follow your instincts at your peril. Dr. Deirdre Barrett's book is called Supernormal Stimuli. And another is Wasteland, the revolutionary science behind our weight and fitness crisis, which explores some of the same themes. So what do you think of all this? Do you think you're captive to your ancestral instincts? Head to abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind and look for Add Your Comment. Look forward to hearing from you there. And more audio from this event, including the audience Q&A, up on the All in the Mind blog. Thanks to Maria Tickle, Kieran Shettigara, and sound engineer Gil Harmon. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next week, Getting Nuclear.
On Hindsight, Australia's only social history radio program.
Young folks, old folks, everybody come. Gather round Hymettus and make yourselves at home. Squeeze up on the sofas and squat upon the floor and hear some Greek mythology you've never heard before.
The Catalysts, one of Australia's oldest and most influential private women's clubs. They've been meeting together for 100 years and now for the first time they're telling their story. And you can download or stream this Hindsight from the Radio National webpage.